At some point during the episode, Johnny mentions the passcode. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you where. You have to listen to the whole thing.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that gives you a peek inside the minds of some truly inspirational teachers. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by Johnny Hall. Hi, Johnny, how are you?
That's about it. Thank you, Kieran. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you back, Johnny, and great to sit down one-on-one, give you a proper Paxman treatment grilling.
I know, when you said, it's the right introduction, that I'm already nervous.
Obviously, I mean, you probably need no introduction, but we always begin with our guests in numbers.
Right.
Just to get a feel for who they are, where they're from. So my first question to you is years as a teacher.
Well, I had to check because I've got my PDC certificate scanned away. And apparently I did my PDC in 2005. So I reckon 18 years, if you don't count your PDC, 19 if you count it, which is a up for debate, I guess, whether your training year even counts as a year of teaching. Some people count it, some people don't.
Really? I mean, yeah, I mean, I can't imagine any teaching I did when I was training actually counted as teaching.
Yeah, in that case, 18 qualified years, let's say. Yeah.
First year group taught?
I remember my very first lesson was year sevens, and I was teaching order of operations, or the dreaded BIDMAS lesson, and it went pretty terribly, I seem to remember it. I think the little year sevens ate me alive, but I'd like to think I've got a bit better since then.
I mean, that's hands down the best answer to that question from a secondary teacher, because it always perplexes secondary teachers. And sometimes you will get like the range of classes. Sometimes you won't get an answer at all. You know,
so I just assumed every teacher would remember exactly what their first ever lesson was. I was absolutely scared, scared silly in the night before. Like, you put so much preparation into it, and then your legs just go to jelly that first lesson. It's amazing. But it is also amazing how quickly those nerves go. I think, like, after you've taught them a few times, it's like, oh, been doing it forever, kind of.
Last year group taught?
Year eights, period five today.
Nice, how'd that go? Were you shaking your boots then too?
What was I doing? I was drawing graphs, direct proportion graphs, so exchange rates and things like that. So not the most exciting lesson for a period five on a Tuesday, but yeah, they seem to get a lot out of it.
I mean, especially as it's a Monday.
Is it Monday? Oh my God. Jeez, yeah. I told you I've been ill. I'm not thinking straight. Oh my God. Yeah. It is Monday. I've planned all my lessons for tomorrow as well. So, yeah, I have planned for Tuesday, though, thankfully. You'll be glad to know.
Most important to your group?
Most important, really. Like, my heart wants to say they're all equally important and stuff like that. But realistically, if you're a secondary teacher, year 11 is the most important year group. Probably followed by year 7, giving them the best start possible and kind of like, you know, setting the expectations and the routines for the rest of the year group. If you nail year 7, then hopefully they'll carry on that through the year groups, but let's not pretend year 11 aren't the most important.
Favourite year group?
Favourite year group? They are all equally my favourite. They're all equally challenging and exciting in different measures. Yeah, the year 7s with their, can I turn over my page and things like that. To all the way up to the year 11s. Yeah, I can't really pick a favourite because that's just not fair of them, especially if any of them listen to this and say, "So you didn't pick me. I don't want to go through that." So it's just not worth it.
Good point. Do you teach all like across the full spread?
Yeah, I've got one of each this year. So 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Obviously, I'm only Monday to Wednesday in my school, which does mean all my classes are split classes, but I do at least have one of each year group, which is nice. I didn't have that last year. I didn't teach any year 9s last year.
That's a busy start to the week. You get all those year groups and
yeah. What about to be fair? This Monday was my because we have a split timetable, so I only had 3 lessons this Monday. But come tomorrow, yeah, ask me if I, yeah. That's why I didn't agree to do it at the end of Tuesday because I've got a 5 period day tomorrow. So yeah, I'll be asleep by now.
Number of websites.
Number of websites. I mean, I've only really got 2. Like, there's the really old ones, like Flash Maths, and Flash doesn't even work anymore, like Adobe Flash. It's still there, though. I just keep renewing it just because it's there. But really, I've got MathSpot and I've got Formtime Ideas. Those are the big two. I did toy around when my little lad, who's 5 now, when I did shared parental leave 5 years ago. And I made a little site called nonexamples.com. And I know Neil was a fan of that. And it's still there. But I've just, there's only so much time you have. So I'm not going to bother renewing that. So if anyone wants the domain name nonexamples.com, it's coming up. It'll come up for a steal at like £10 a year in a few months. So claim it. But what I will do, rather than waste all that code, I'll probably put the effort to port it all over to MassBot and just have it all in one big site.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, you told me how massive your server was, so you might as well have that available.
I mean, I pay enough for it now. They've jacked up the price like threefold last year. So, hence the plea for patrons, really.
I mean, you deserve as many patrons as possible. Number of form time ideas?
Oh, there's thousands and thousands, but apparently not enough because I still get emails saying, when are you going to add some more jokes? And my reply is always, well, if you send me a list of jokes, so long as they're clean and they're funny, then I'll upload them to the site. So if you've got some great facts or some jokes or whatever the other activities are, then yeah, send them my way and I'll get them uploaded. But again, that's kind of just like being sat there. It's kind of cool. It's like, it's one of those sites that I spent 2 weeks on, an Easter, 10 years ago now, literally, it's a decade old now. Spent the whole Easter holiday making it because I thought it was cool. Enjoyed making it. And then hopefully over the last 10 years, it saved people quite a lot of time because it's just one of those one-click resources. And I mean, the kids just gravitate towards the flags every single time and they love it. But there's a load of other nice stuff on there as well. So if you've not seen it, yeah, check out Form Time Ideas.
Number of MathSpot features?
188. Yep. I just counted now just before I came on. I did say, I joked with Joe Morgan, actually, I think it was about 3 years ago, that I'm going to stop at 100 because I think, like, I got on those maths gems. Then eventually Joe just doesn't put me on the maths gems anymore. She says, oh, everyone knows about you, so there's no point putting you on, which, I mean, I'd still like to be on a maths gem if you are listening, Joe. Yeah, but I did make a joke, I'm going to stop at 100 and then, like, go back and make every other resource a little bit better. That's obviously gone out the window because I'm up to 188. But I have recently actually got rid of a couple of real junk ones. Like go back and look over your lesson plans from like 10 years ago and you think, oh God, what was I thinking? It's the same thing when you look at a resource that you made 10 years ago and think, I don't want people using this in the classroom. So a few resources I've slyly just deleted and no one's got back to me yet saying, Johnny, where's that resource gone? So fingers crossed, no one was using it. Some of the ones which are used loads, like, which I wasn't keen on. Like, there was the question generator, one of the question generators. It was terrible. So I did spend a Thursday afternoon making it all miles better. And I did actually release that on Twitter saying, like, you can put, like, URL parameters and stuff like that and save it and things like that. So 188, and I'm trying to keep it roughly down to that.
Number of rooms required as a minimum for one of your sessions, Johnny?
One. I'm not big-headed. I know you joked when you was in Dubai and I had two rooms or something daft like that. But yeah, one will do me fine. I'm grateful for anyone that turned up to my session. And yeah, it's the delegates that make a good session. It's not what I talk about. I just hand about nice bits of plastic and coloured plastic and people play with them. That's all.
And number of tweets.
How many? What's that?
Number of
tweets. Oh, I don't know. I missed that question. Shall I have a look? It tells you on Twitter, doesn't it, if you load on?
It does.
So number of tweets, apparently, 19,900. And it rounds that, doesn't it? Or it might truncate it. I don't know. I'm guessing it truncates it, so it wouldn't round up. So I don't know. My next tweet could be my 20,000. 20,000.
Oh, yeah. You're going to need to make it a special MathSpot tweet.
How do you actually know? Does it? If you hover over, does it tell you?
This episode's going to center around MathSpot,
mm-hmm.
but you're a teacher, developer, mathematical task designer, amongst many other things. Tell us about your journey and how you got here.
So my journey, well, obviously I mentioned I trained 18 years ago now up in Leeds Trinity, and then I did a couple of years maternity cover. And back in the day, like, there wasn't a vast shortage of maths teachers like they are nowadays. So this maternity teacher cover came back and I didn't have a job anymore. It wasn't like the scenario nowadays where like you just do anything to keep a maths teacher at your school. So I had to find another place. I did love that school and they were sad to leave me, but obviously you can't just take someone's job. So then I moved to what's now known Leeds City Academy. and I've now been there ever since. It was City Leeds School, now Leeds City Academy, and it's been through some changes over the years, and now, well, it's just like, well, you don't stay at a place for 16 years unless it's kind of a special place to you. The kids are absolutely lovely. It has its challenges, just like every school does, but yeah, I'm not going to spend 16 years there if I don't love it. That's my teaching side of things. I've been head of department for about 5 years at some point. I've been lead practitioner for the last maybe 6-7 years or something like that. And yeah, and now recently, in the last 4 years, I've basically dropped down to 3 days teaching, Monday to Wednesday, and 2 days I've been working for Complete Maths for the last 4 years, and more recently I've gone it alone, shall we say, with trying to develop MathSpot and make it as good as can possibly be. So that's my current situation: lead practitioner, 3 days a week, and 2 days math spotting.
16 years is a long time. And you're thinking that you've got this great environment. Why would you invite Dave Taylor to work there?
Why would you invite me? For the listeners that don't know him, I also work with Dave. I mean, I've known Dave for probably more than a decade, because he was at another school. I'll not mention, give any personal details with Dave out. He was at another school, and then a job came up at ours, and I was like, Dave, please come work for us. Because I'm sure Catherine Darwin won't mind mentioning that I had the pleasure of working with Catherine last year, who's then gone on to bigger and greater things with Dr. Frost. And then Catherine's lead practitioner role opened up, and I was like, straight on the phone for Dave. Dave, please come and join us. And so now me and Dave Taylor are both working there, which is a nice little team so far. I mean, I've only been working with him for a month, so hopefully I'm not getting on his nerves too much.
You and Catherine would talk about your completion tables. I'm sure you and Dave are talking about
backward examples. He's not actually pestered me that much. I mean, to be fair, we're only 4 weeks in and he's still getting his feet in the new environment. I reckon it's not going to be long before he starts pestering me with backwards. He's done it once, to be fair. He said, Johnny, what do you reckon about taking a GCSE paper and like producing backwards faded versions of the whole thing? I'm like, great, Dave, get cracking. Like, I'm not sure how long it's going to take him, but he's a machine. I mean, you work with Dave, you know how fast he works. He'll probably get it done in half an hour. But yeah, watch this space. Backward faded exam papers maybe coming out of Dave Taylor sometime soon.
We've spoken about manipulatives on the podcast, mm-hmm. different sort of maths aspects. But MathSpot is something that we always recommend teachers utilize. But when I see other teachers sharing their photographs on social media or sharing them with friends and things, I'm thinking, I don't use that bit enough. Or, oh, I didn't know that was a thing. And so I thought, you spend a lot of time over the summer really trying to develop MathSpot. And I thought it'd be fantastic to sort of share what the full capacity is, you know, because I'm sure the bits that I tell people about are only a fraction. Mm-hmm. But I think it makes sense to start at the beginning. Where did the idea for MathSpot come from, and which came first, learning to code or the idea?
All right, well, the learning to code one's easy, because I the learning to code came much earlier, because I don't know if you remember those BBC micro computers back in the day. My dad bought me one of those when I was about 6 or 7, and he bought me like a little book where you'd copy out the program line by line, and then you'd hit run, and then you'd play like whatever Space Invaders or whatever you coded in. And then you'd study the code, and then the next section of the book was, okay, do you want to try and learn to write your own kind of program? And it got me hooked on there. So once you know how to program, that was obviously like BBC Basic, but once you know how to program, it's transferable. The key words and the syntax might be slightly different, but essentially it's all about loops and things like that. It's pretty easy. And like, as a maths teacher, like, you're essentially just choosing two random numbers and adding them together, and the computer does all the hard work of actually doing the maths. You just tell it the process to do so. The coding came first. As to why it came around, though, basically, we got told that every lesson, you know, needs those like 1-star, 2-star, 3-star difficulties. I got told that, okay, every lesson in the department needs this same structure for every lesson. I'm like, so you've got to write those by hand for potentially five lessons for every day. And it's not even that great. It's not even that great practice anyway. I mean, it's useful. It's got its you know, sometimes it's useful, but most of the time it's probably not. You can probably do something better with the time. So I thought, right, I'm just going to like see if I can automate it. So I just did like a little mock-up, and I showed it this guy just to get him off my back, and he was like blown away with it, saying, "Oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen." And that's how MathSpot started, weirdly. Just me trying to solve a work kind of problem, I guess, in that context. And then, yeah, then I quickly realized that's probably not the best thing on the site, not the best resource on the site. And I started making better things. But essentially, from that very first little problem of how can I make my job a little bit easier.
When I'm talking to teachers about MathSpot, I'm thinking, you know, this will make your life easier. This will make your job easier. Because things that, like you say, you have to do manually or that you might have to generate yourself can be generated. I mean, I've worked through, you know, the section where you generate the almost like test style questions. You know, you've got your crossover and you've got your foundation and your higher.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So whenever I don't have an indefinite or an infinite bank of questions, but whenever I'm working with, say, 15, 16-year-olds, that'll be my first port of call. I took quite a lot of our teaching assistants through the GCSEs, through the Foundation GCSE in 2017, 18. I would use that as my sort of bank whenever it came to revision time. So we went through a sequence over the first year, and then the second year, I would stick on MathSpot and have an idea of this is what I want to model, because it was the test taking technique that they were worried about and stuff.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted it to be used for. Like most of those questions are basically questions that I coded because one of my classes at some point will have struggled on a particular mock question like that. So I said, okay, right, if we're struggling on this, let's randomly generate so you can have a lot of practice at it. And then I'd kind of like give them weekly iterative tests. So like they'd do a mock paper, and then for about 3 or 4 weeks, I'd teach them the stuff that they messed up on the test, and like every week give them a weekly test with that question in. And then after the end of the second week, they've got two questions and then three questions and so on. And it really helped. Well, you can't say for certain whether it really helps or not, but like, one year group where I did that for was like one of the best results one of the best results the kids got. So yeah, I've been a big fan of weekly testing ever since that. Ever since like the words iterative and stuff like that became like buzzwords. I just called it weekly test about 12 years ago. Maybe not 12 years ago, MathSpot didn't exist then. Maybe about, yeah, maybe 7 years ago.
When you mentioned Flash earlier on, I guessed that the answer might be that the coding came first. But then, you know, those BBC computers, all the big tech geniuses cut their teeth on those, didn't they? You know what I mean? So do they still make them for kids too? I mean, I want to get my kids some.
I don't know. I think, isn't it all about like Raspberry Pis now or something? I don't know. You probably speak to your computing expert, but I know they do that Scratch programming as well. And I'm not too sort of au fait on that, but yeah, when I started coding, it was just a black screen and a white flashing cursor saying "Welcome to Basic." Then you'd type like 10 auto, you'd start coding like that. So very, very old school, but it was a great fun. Hours and hours of my childhood wasted doing it. Well, not wasted. Hopefully, I put it to use later down the line. It's just always been a hobby, and maths has always been a hobby. And I guess I'm quite lucky to, you know. I really do like maths, and I get to teach maths. And then when I go home, I do hobbies related to maths as well. And then I go to maths conference at the weekend and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah.
And the life of a maths teacher.
I do other stuff as well, by the way. I'm not just maths. I like me running. I like woodworking and things like that. Big fan of the garden.
How often do you play the guitar behind you, Johnny?
Oh yeah, I've got a guitar as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's all maths.
I'm not playing it now, though, Kieran. I'm not playing it now.
Yeah, see that for Atoll's episode.
No, mainly because I'll get absolutely killed because the one-year-old's just gone to sleep.
Yeah, I mean, most of the computing teaching, to my knowledge, in primary is block-based. So like you say about loops and things like that there. I think the bit that, certainly whenever I taught computing, I never really got across the language aspect and the idea that, you know, computing and the language, you know, it's looking for those patterns and things just like you would when you're learning English.
Sometimes I'll show kids how like you can just literally fire up Notepad like what any computer has, and like that's all you need to make a website. Like, and I'll just quickly fire up. I did like an after school coding club once. So I just fired up Notepad and just like in about 2 minutes showed them how to create like a randomly generated math worksheet just by using a for loop and tell them how many questions you want and then just choose your X and Y, add them together. And it's like they're amazed at almost how like simple it can actually be. And I've not just kids I've shown as well. I've shown like a few interested math teachers. Like they say, "Oh, how do you do it?" And I'll just send them like a template file, say, "Have a play with this." Because you open it up, you right click, open it in like the source mode, and just it should be self-explanatory for any math teacher just to be able to read it and see what the variables are, change them, see how they're going to change. It's dead straightforward, and it's really good fun as well. So and. One thing I've really found is like, do you know, like when you're trying to get a real deep understanding of a topic or a question, actually coding a question which generates that, like the ability to do that is great CPD. Like, I was coding a question on like rationalizing the denominator last night, as you do on a Sunday, and like it's dead easy just to rationalize it just by sort of multiplying the numerator and the denominator. But then the hard bit is like, how are you going to ensure that like it all simplifies nicely, or if it doesn't simplify? And before you know it, you're getting into all sorts of like nuts and bolts of the number. And it essentially all boils down to prime factorization and the fundamental theorem of arithmetic. You've got to be checking against all these primes and stuff. And it just shows all these links between math that like you might not have necessarily realized if you hadn't coded a question. It's like when you get kids maybe to make up a question of their own, make up a hard question, make up an easy question, make up a question that looks hard but is actually easy, and getting them to think about that those sort of prompts. I think it's a similar thing that goes on when I'm coding MathSpot questions. You really have to get under the bonnet of the math that's going on. So yeah, I can recommend it a decent CPD as well, to be honest, as well as being great fun. Maybe we could do a conference session on that one day.
Yeah, no, I think
If
I should do
people are
that.
interested, yeah. What I've learned from coding MathSpot, that could be an interesting title.
Because you really have to think about all the parameters, all, like you say, all the variables,
Absolutely, yeah.
because it's not going to generalize if something's out of place, is it?
Every question that I code for MathSpot, I don't know, it goes from a 0 to 10 difficulty scale. I've changed the word to difficulty on purpose because I used to call it a level 0 to 10, and people were like, "Oh, what key stage level is this at all? What GCSE grade is this?" Like, it's not, and it's just a difficulty. What I think is the easiest possible instance of this concept, up to what I think is the hardest you'd realistically ever want to do. So, like the rationalizing denominator one I was mentioning, like is a dead simple sort of integer over a third with no common factors, all the way up to where you've got loads of common factors to simplify at the end. I pass this function into what I call the differentiator, which has got all these 10 levels and like the variables change. And it's coding the actual question normally takes me 5 minutes. Coding the differentiator for it to get all these levels right is a trial and error game, and it can often take me like couple of hours till I'm really happy with it. And there's loads on maths, but I'll look back at now. And now I've got a bit of time, and I'm thinking, I've learned a lot in the last 10 years, and I need to go back and fix that. And most of the time, it's because I've tried to cram too much into one concept. And what I need to do is go back and actually split it into two separate questions. Like there's one called fractions of amounts, but really it needs splitting out into sort of like maybe unit fractions of amounts and non-unit fractions of amounts, and going a little bit more sort of granular in the question. Not to all of them, like rounding's another classic example. If you click on rounding, it's got all of rounding from like nearest integer to nearest 10 to decimal places all the way to sig figures. And I made that like probably 9 years ago, maybe 10 years ago now, but that needs sorting. Like you're not going to teach all them in a lesson, so why would you have them all in one concept? They need splitting out into rounding to integers, rounding to powers of 10, rounding to decimals, rounding to significant figures. It's potentially four more questions. Then each of those will have a slider from 0 to 10. Like those tricky decimal place ones where like the 9 carries forward and clocks everything round and things like that. There's a just thinking how much work I've got to do on it. There's not enough time in the day. It's a lifelong job this is going to be.
mean, that's definitely, you've got enough for a couple of mass comp talks there, Johnny. It's like, you know, that's the nuts and bolts of thinking about the questions you set for pupils and things. Like you say, you know, how often do we try and put too much content into one, say, sequence, that kind of thing? Yeah, I think
And
you're
I'm all
onto something.
yeah, and I'm also yeah, I'm also conscious of like there is a massive sort of maths teacher, well, teacher shortage in general, like, and there's lots of there's new maths teachers as well. So I want MathSpot to be sort of like almost a tool that, like, kind of holds the hand a little bit. They want to be able to go on and say, okay, I'm introducing this topic. If I know that if I start on level zero, that'll probably be a decent example problem pair, to maybe show the class. It's still never going to be as good as the teacher sitting down and thinking of what examples they want to use, but I'm not naive enough to realize that I sort of like, you know, that's not always the case. Sometimes people have 5 period days, they just fire up MathSpot and they just take whatever it gives them. And I want to make sure that whatever it gives them is as good as possible. So you do feel a bit of sense of sort of like responsibility when you've got so many people using it. Like you want it to be good, because essentially, like, there's kids at the end of this which are using your stuff, and if you're serving them up rubbish, then it's your fault basically. So yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I haven't seen any rubbish on there yet, but
Oh,
I'll keep.
and maybe I mean you're always critical of your own stuff, so I know there's lots and lots to be done. There's lots of good stuff, don't get me wrong, but I've got like this to-do list that I've got. If I showed it, yeah. It's hundreds of items long. Yeah, and that's before I even add Neil Armand's suggestions.
Yeah, his private connection via Patreon.
Absolutely.
What do you think are the three most important features on MathSpot, and how can teachers get the most from them?
I can tell you the one I use every day without fail for every lesson almost, and that's my camera tool, my visualizer tool, recently sponsored by Hue Cameras. So buy a Hue visualizer if you're hearing this. And it's just literally, it's on the homepage of MathSpot, the little camera in the corner. You click on that and it just fires up your visualizer. And it's just really useful, rather than loading up a separate piece of software like the camera tool on Windows, because you can have it in your tabs. So you can just flick them back. You can actually have several cameras open if you really want to, all at the same time. So I use that without fail at every lesson, because there's very rarely a lesson where at some point a kid won't say something and say, oh, let's just go over that under the visualizer, or I'll be doing an example problem pair or something. And more often than not, I much prefer to do it under a visualizer than like a digital version. I know I've been saying how like I want MathSpot to be as good as possible, but like I don't think, well, I know that what's on MathSpot, which is generated by a computer, is never going to be as good as what a human can go through under a visualizer. That's a big statement. And I know with AI going mental at the moment and stuff like that, but I don't believe there's any going to be a situation where we're not doing it under the visualizer and responding to the needs of the class there and then is not going to be better than a computer generated one, because you don't know if little Jimmy over there is paying attention and stuff like that. The computer can't tell that, but as you're doing an example under the visualizer, you can spot out and keep an eye on these things. So yeah, the visualizer tool is a big one for me.
There are some companies, I mean, really big names in the sort of AI slash maths world, who believe that AI will be as responsive as teachers. Do you think they're missing the mark?
I can't see it happening before I'm retired. I'm not saying it won't happen, but like, I guess it's a bit like, you know, like the maybe the chess computer debate from like a few years ago. Like if, in the 1990s, it was just no contest. Humans would beat computers, and then at some point in the 90s, I can't remember what it was like 92 or something, when that deep blue faced Garry Kasparov or something, and then the computers won the first game, and like ever since that moment, like, literally, humans don't have a chance against a computer now. Maybe there will be that tipping point. I can't see it happening for a good 20 years or so, or something like that. And I'm hoping to have retired within 20 years, to be honest. I can't still see me teaching into my 60s. So no, I'll never say never, but now I don't think we're anywhere close to a computer being better than an expert practitioner under a visualizer, bigging myself up there a little bit. But like, I've been doing this for 18 years. Like, maybe a computer might be better than someone that's maybe brand new to teaching, but not at the moment, I don't think.
No, I'm with you. I just thought I'd throw it your way with your expertise, because there's almost like this, I don't know, transient information that you pass on to the pupils when you're working with manipulatives. You know, I always talk about movement and how important it is, for instance, in the structures of arithmetic, you know, because the distinction between augmentation and aggregation is one of context and movement, you know? And so I think we look at the body language and the behavior of the other person. Yeah. I don't know if an avatar could replace that. I'm sure someone's studying that as we speak. But there's something in this, you know, this bringing everything together that expresses something that you can only sort of hope to achieve.
Probably going to be relatively easy to program computers to like pick up maybe common misconceptions that pupils might say. So I don't know if they're multiplying by 10, 1.2 multiplied by 10 and they stick on a zero or something. It'd be dead easy to code that misconception. If a kid types in 1.20, then the computer could easily pick up that misconception. But it's more about the things that go on in a lesson that kids notice. And like all the time, kids will maybe just make a statement that they've noticed something, or they've come up with something themselves. And like, I don't see how you're going to get a computer to respond in the moment to that, because quite often a kid might say something really interesting and then your lesson goes down a rabbit hole for 10 minutes. I guess, I suppose like you could make the argument, should you go down the rabbit hole? Are you wasting time? I guess it's an opportunity cost kind of thing there. But in terms of like the kid's experience of a maths lesson and the enjoyment of it, I do think those are quite valuable moments. I know Sam Blatherwick has a lot of these moments. I've seen him do a few presentations now, and he always blows my mind with his enthusiasm. If you told him that he's never allowed to go off on one in a lesson on a tangent, I'm sure he'd be devastated. But that does raise the moral question of like, just because you enjoy it, is it strictly better than sticking to the straight and narrow road of this is the curriculum, this is what I must teach next, rather than showing the little wonderful nuggets of math that appear just because a kid's asking a really nice question.
The sheer number of responses that pupils might give, and then those responses might change depending on where you are in the country or in the world, even if they're all speaking English. You know, it's the expert teacher who recognizes the mistake in what's been said, isn't it? You know, so that, you know, I think you'd have a tough time. Although if the program was making itself smarter based on the input it was getting, who knows? But yeah, I'm with you. I think maths teachers aren't in danger of becoming extinct anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't think it's a problem I need to worry about in my career. Maybe if you're a brand new teacher now and you've got 40 years ahead of you, maybe there'll be big changes then, but I don't know. Maybe I team maths but up with ChatGPT and see what happens.
Well, I mean, it can't do maths, can it?
It can do so. Actually, you say that, but like, you can ask it things like how many zeros at the end of like, say 200 factorial, and that's quite a well-known problem, so it gets that right and it gives you the explanation. But then you can change it to, okay, how many zeros would be at the end of say 187 factorial? But it can do the maths for that as well. I was quite impressed. It was Rob that showed me that one, so I was like, bloody hell, Rob, that's quite impressive, because that's taking some quite well, it's university level maths. I remember doing it on my numbers and proofs module. But then it gets some ridiculously easy things wrong as well. So it swings and roundabouts, I guess.
It didn't fare very well on. I was testing it out with the treasure hunt questions for this week's MathsCon.
All right.
And it didn't do very well on the ones that Stuart wrote.
Well, that's Stuart, isn't it, really? Stuart's the problem there.
You mentioned the camera.
The tool I use the second most, that's still rubbish English, is probably my test maker resource. And it's one of the growing in popularity, mainly because I've done a redirect from what I considered a rubbish resource, and it redirects it to the test maker now. So basically, everyone that was trying to get to the old resource gets an automatic redirection to the test maker. So it's building a bit of traffic there. It is miles better, because essentially it's the entire bank of MathsBot, and there's a nice little search function on it, and you can just pick and choose the topics that you've taught. And we start all our lessons with like a 5-minute do now. So with my year 11s, so far I've taught them a bit of fractions, a bit of standard form, a bit of laws of indices. So my start for tomorrow's lesson, I'll just literally type those keywords in and just generate a 6-question or 8-question little recall on those topics. And as I teach them more topics, going back to that iterative idea, I'll just keep adding the topics. And it's so useful just for just keeping on top of the basics, because we're all guilty of like teaching a topic as like a discrete unit and then just kind of like moving on and then not visiting that topic as much as you can do. And then before you know it, it's just like you've never even taught the topic in the first place to him. So this test maker that I've produced is my way of just kind of like making sure that we just go back and revisit those topics. Again, it's not like the most exciting maths in the world, but I do think it's useful. And the kids can see themselves sort of like retaining that knowledge a little bit better. And if you want to do an end of half term test or something, you have as many questions as you want. And the recent addition I've made is, like I said, those URL parameters in, so you can now save what topics you've chosen. So like I can literally now make that test for the fractions, the standard forms, the indices, save the URL, and then when I've taught another topic, say similar triangles, just fire it up again, add that topic to it, save the URL again, and then it's nowhere, or literally you just have to add an extra topic and save it and just paste it into your PowerPoint, paste it into your spreadsheet or whatever you want. So the plan is now this feature, and it's not just on the test maker, it's rolled across all of the question generators, because this one bank of question feeds like several resources, and they all can be now sort of like I say, you can put the parameters in the URL and just save it wherever you want on your scheme. So the idea is hopefully at some point, whether MathBot might even become its own scheme or curriculum itself, or people will start linking to MathBot from their own schemes, either in an Excel spreadsheet or if they use some fancy technology or whatever that way as well. So that's the ultimate aim, which hopefully people will start doing now once they realize they can do it. I'm not sure it's very well known yet. I did a little promo video on it, but I mean, it only got like a couple of hundred views. So if people don't figure it out themselves, I'm not sure how many people are going to watch this. So maybe they'll watch it and think, yeah, I'll try that out.
How recognizable would primary teachers find some of the questions? Because obviously I think there's quite a lot in the foundation paper that they would actually think, oh, that's stuff we teach as well.
Yeah, well, this goes back to when I said I'll look back at the stuff and I'm like a little bit embarrassed, maybe, like, because the whole of addition is one question on MathBot. Now, if you tell that to a primary teacher, like addition's just like one lesson, they're probably going to look at you mad. So one of my things on my to-do list is to split up addition into its proper parts. Like you showed me that teaching children to calculate mentally, was it? Is that the name of it?
Yes.
So I've still got it saved on my phone, and that, like, basically it breaks addition down into it's all its different, but, well, it's not just addition, it's got all the operations in. So the plan is to have a whole section on MathBot called mental calculations, and then the whole of that massive booklet, like near doubles and things like that. And I mean, I'm not au fait with all the primary terminology, but yeah, there's a lot of work to do there. So that's a Thursday plan. It'll probably take me a good 3 or 4 days to probably work through all that, though. But it's essentially loads and loads of really easy bits of coding, because it's just addition, subtraction, multiplication. There's no crazy things going on. I just need to make sure that, like, because there'll be somewhere like the unit's digits carries and somewhere the unit digits don't carry into the tens. Like, we're talking that sort of level of granularity. So that's the plan. So basically, I want it to be really useful for primary teachers, as well as obviously myself as a secondary, because I mean, secondary teachers will benefit from that as well, because we always get those kids that are still struggling with the basics.
I think that will be a game changer, Johnny, because I think confidence with those mental methods is the distinguishing feature between proficient primary age mathematicians and those who struggle. I think it was Tolan Gray said, the kids who don't see that those relationships, they do twice the work for half the payoff, because quite often they're using the former written algorithm and they're getting it wrong, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. I like that formal written algorithm, I reckon, does more harm than good. Like, I've got my little 5-year-old, and like I'm purposely refusing to show it him, because like we spend our sort of Sunday mornings maybe doing a bit of maths, like, and I'll ask him things like 37 add 65 or something like that. And like he talks me through his little journey, what he's gonna do. And like, so he says, right, I've got my 3 tens and my 6 tens, add them together, that's gonna be 9 tens, but then I've got a problem with my 7 and my 5, because that's gonna make another 10. And he talks me through all these problems, and he's getting a little bit faster each time he does it. And my question, and I don't know the answer, you're the expert here, like, at what point do you introduce the column method, just to speed things up a little bit? Because he's doing everything right, he knows what he's doing, but I fear that if I give him the column method now, that's too early, because he's not cemented all those little number bond facts and stuff like that. And if I just give him a little get out, do the 7 and the 5 12, write the 2, carry the 1, all of a sudden you're not having those stories about the tens and the units anymore, and I don't want to take that away from him. So I guess 5's probably a bit too young to introduce the formal column method, but he's quite good at maths for his age, I guess. But like, I don't know, what would you do in that situation?
You'd be surprised. I have seen 5-year-olds introduced to it. Thing is, it's quite often introduced in the absence of those rich conversations about how we can manipulate numbers and what's most efficient. You know, sometimes the formal algorithms are more efficient. I mean, I've timed myself doing a range of different problems in the past, and sometimes I could use the formal algorithm quicker than I could mentally manipulate. But with addition, subtraction, with a lot of multiplication, there are, you know, if you use the laws of arithmetic, you use the relationships between different numbers and the proximity of the numbers to your advantage, then that's actually being more proficient, I think. It's officially introduced in Key Stage 1, maybe supposedly sort of halfway through towards the end. I wouldn't go near it until year 3 at the earliest, when kids are, what, 7, 8 years old? But that's, you know, you can expect whenever he's in year 2, they've definitely covered it by then, if not earlier.
Yeah. So long as he knows what's going on, that's the main thing for me. Like, because what I was talking about with this, we had the Q's and air odds as well, and we told the story with the Q's and air odds as well. So he literally had the tens in his hands, he had the other odds, and he could put the 5 and the 7 together and swap it out for a 10 and a 2. So he knows what's going on, but I just don't want that to be lost yet with just an abstract formal method. I see it all the time in year 7, like kids just have come and like they just don't get it, especially when it comes to the subtraction, like, and it's like maybe 2 minus 7 in the units, and like, they just do 7 minus 2 because that's what they can do. They don't think to exchange because they don't know what it actually means. They've just been taught to do subtraction and write down the answer. And something's gone really wrong if you get into that stage. And I don't think there's a quick fix from there, because they've been shown this column method addition, and they think it's really quick, even though they get all their answers wrong. It's a terrible situation to be in. I feel as though there should be almost some sort of like driving test that you have to do, right? You can only use the column method addition if you can prove to me that you know exactly what's going on in all these steps, because otherwise it's just like, could potentially be more harm than good.
It always felt to me like that was the very definition of a misconception, because they've clearly overgeneralized to the point where they think that no matter what happens, no matter what the situation is, I'm just going to take this one and this one.
Take the smallest from the biggest, no matter where the biggest is, whether it's on the top or the bottom, I don't care. Just going to do it.
For all of you Kofi, Kofi, Kofufu, however you pronounce it, you damn lovely supporters, it's a song going out to you, to you. Here we go. Nikki, Anna, P, Seth, D, Stephanie, Taylor, Mrs. B, Issa, Taya, Adam, Katie, Liv, Dempsey, Becca, Jenfred, Susie, Brown, Nancio, Necio, Rachel, I am Al, Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington. Jessica, Tom Oakley, Tom Brassington, LJ. And last but not least, my lovely little Amy Bills. Oh, they help us pay the bills. Oh, a massive thank you out to Dabbe family. Coffee supporters help us keeping it ad-free. There's far more content coming just round the bend. Thank you all for helping our very special friends. Friends. Very special friends.
I mean, we've not really talked about the virtual manipulative. That's got to be like one of the biggest. It's not the most used, but like the question generators are still the most used, but the manipulatives have grown massively in recent years, because obviously like they've been quite big nationally as well. I think loads of organizations have been promoting them, so yeah, they are used quite extensively now. In particular, like the algebra tiles have been used, which is nice, in secondary, and the big one in primary is I'm guessing it's primary, place value counters have been used loads now on MathSpot, a lot more than the Dean's blocks, which I find interesting. Because essentially you can only understand place value counters once you understand place value, because all the counters are the same size, and Dean's blocks gives you that relative size of each one. So I always think place values are just like a little stepping stone between the Dean's blocks and the abstract. They're basically just abstract symbols that you can move around. So I guess probably because you can fit thousands on the screen a lot easier because they're nice and small and discreet. But yeah, I found that interesting how much more the place value counters are used than the Dean's blocks. It's probably by a factor of maybe like 5 or 6, which I think is interesting.
It is. I think, yeah, obviously you've got very specific situations where you use the sort of the blocks because you're exploring the magnitude of inherent and place value. And I think quite often the counters are used, like you said. I mean, I think we've discussed one of the videos I did where I use them whenever I want to represent the mental manipulation I want my pupils to do. But you can often find that they're also being used as like a one-to-one correspondence. You know, there are 7 in this, they just happen to be in the thousands block. If I'm subtracting 4, well, I've got 3 of those left, and whether or not they understand fully is up for debate. You know, so I think you might find that a lot of them have been used in secondary schools too, because it's that sort of 4-digit addition subtraction that might be the sticking point.
Oh yeah, I absolutely 100% see their appeal. Like they're much more easy to use than getting massive 7,000 red Dean's blocks. Yeah, it's just so long as the kids have made that leap to what place value is, which you have before you start using place value counters. You need to know that this one that says 10 on it is worth 10 of these same size ones, which just happen to say a 1 on it. Rather, with the Dean's blocks, this 10 is literally 10 times bigger than the unit. There's no mistake there. It's just interesting. And Q's and air rods are hardly used at all on the site, which is disappointing, because that, in terms of fun, those are definitely one of the most fun, versatile, powerful manipulatives I think there are. So maybe we need a bit more CPD on people using Q's and air rods a bit. I suppose they are a bit more specialist, maybe. I don't know. I mean, maybe they're just not as much fun virtually than they are the physical ones, where you can build little towers and stuff like that. Whereas the Dean's blocks and the place value counters, they're not fun anyway, even if you've got the physical ones. The Dean's blocks, maybe. But they are really useful when you're learning the arithmetic. Maybe that's the factor.
Yeah, I think anyone who's gone to the lengths to develop their CPD with regards to Cuisenaire rods will probably also extend towards buying.
Yeah.
Because like you say, there's so much of that early identification of the relationships between the different rods. It's a physical act, isn't it? You know? And I think it's later, like you say, quick manipulation, quick modeling as a teacher that can be useful virtually. But it's because you have to get to spend a lot of time to get really proficient with them. I think you might as well then spend the 20-odd quid or whatever it is on a set for yourself.
I know we've spoken at length, haven't we, about like the pros and cons of various manipulatives, whether it's physical or virtual. We'll eventually get around to doing a CBD session, I'm sure we'll at some point. Like, but for now, it's safe to say that yeah, there's pros and cons of each, isn't there, really? And the virtual ones are quick, pixel perfect, and for a secondary teacher, I think potentially often more useful than the physical counterparts.
I think in particular during times of reasonable austerity, affordable for schools to engage with as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are the big three things, but like crucially, the main thing that I'm trying to do now with all those three things is link them all together. So I've mentioned the camera tool, I've mentioned the question generators, and I've mentioned the manipulatives. The big thing that I've been scratching my brain of over the last few Thursdays is basically I've trawled through every single question on MassBot, and I've started to assign it to a manipulative if one's appropriate. So like anything that's to do with arithmetic, I've assigned it like Dean's blocks or Q's and A rods. If it's to do with ratio, then I've assigned it like the bar model tool or Q's and A rods again. And like it's some questions can have multiple manipulatives. Anything to do with prime factors, obviously I have my prime factor tiles and stuff like that. So now any question on the generator, if you load it up using the example problem pair tool, you press new questions and you get the usual options like regenerate question, hide question, so you can hide the question on the other side of the screen. But also, whatever manipulatives I think are appropriate to model that question with, and I've gone through it like with a fine-tooth comb, so hopefully it's correct. If you spot any errors, let me know. Then a little box will appear and you can click on that and it'll fire up that manipulative with the question on the manipulative as well now, like embedded within the manipulative. It won't answer that, it won't show you how to model it. That's still up to the teacher expertise. And it goes back to that conversation I guess we had about AI. I don't think we're in a position yet where a computer is going to be able to just sit back and get the computer to model it. No. You fire up the question, you've got the question, you've got the model, you've got the tools there. Then it's up to the teacher to give this expert modeling of how you actually solve that question. So basically it's getting all the sections of the site to kind of talk to each other, but ultimately it's the teacher that does the teaching. And so that's the big thing I'm kind of passionate about with MassBot going forwards. And I've done quite a lot in the last couple of weeks, and it's surprising how much you can get done when you actually give yourself a full day to crack on with it. So it was a bit of a slog, but yeah, it started happening. So I've done it. So every question is linked with Dean's, Q's and A, prime factor tiles, bar modeling, and algebra tiles. So those big five are all done. I haven't done place value counts yet. Well, that's going to be dead easy because I'm just going to look what I tick for Dean's blocks, and it's going to be the same for place value counters. I'm pretty much sure of that. So once I've linked it to place value counters as well, then that'll be a quick win as well, and people will be hopefully pleased with that because that's one of the most used manipulatives on the site. It's just that I've left it to last just because of my own personal bias, I think.
I think we'll also have to sit down once you've done your mental methods, sitting down and looking at two color counters and multi-link cubes and that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, I've not
So I think
thought about it. Yeah, two color
that's.
counters I've got to do as well. Yeah, so all the anything to do with directed number as well. To be fair, anything directed number at the moment is linked to algebra tiles because two color counters are just a little subset of algebra tiles anyway. All you need is the yellow and red tile. So anything directed number fires up the algebra tile model for now. But yeah, there is the two color counted resource and the directed counters as well. Yeah, I said I was doing all right. There's a lot to do.
I
When
mean,
you
I was
start
thinking about
talking about it,
the two color counters for things like the 5 frames that you've got and the 10 frames. Well, actually, I think you can go quite.
well, once, yeah, there isn't really things like, yeah, there's not much on number bonds and stuff like that. And subitizing as well. Do you do randomly generated questions on that? How many dots are there? Maybe.
Well, I mean, I try to use your machine, but I always struggle to get the slider on the right amount of time. So I'm like two when I'm demonstrating to people, I'm like 2.75 seconds or whatever.
Right,
But
that's the
something like
sort of thing
that.
you should be telling me, Kieran, and then I can fix that because it's only like it's a 10-minute job, Kieran, to fix
Oh no,
that.
he said the line. It's user error. It's my poor use of the mice. I mean, I'll test it out.
Yeah, but you say that though. But like when you're a teacher in the thick of the moment, like you don't want to have to worry about user error. So these are the things that are actually important to me, and actual teachers using this in real life settings. That's the most valuable feedback I can get, really. Obviously, one of the reasons MathSpot I think is quite good is because I do use it Monday to Wednesday. And then I get all this lovely feedback from Twitter and DMs and emails and all sorts from actual teachers using the resource. And you can't replicate that. Like if I just say quit teaching completely now and just work through my to-do list on MathSpot and finish that, yeah, that'd be decent. But like, where are the new ideas going to come from? Where's the feedback? Where's the improvements going to come from? Like it needs to be used, and it's an ever-changing sort of beast that's always evolving. So please just hammer me with a request, or even if it's a little bug thing like that, just let me know, because things like that are a quick fix.
Yeah, I will do. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of. And I genuinely thought it was my fault, but I like that you've got the die and you've got the different representations on there. I mean, I often use the two color counters in the five frame because you can change that, you can swap up the colors different ways and stuff like that there. I think there's loads of early maths on MathSpot that right for teachers to engage with, you know, big time.
Now that's another, yeah, there is that primary section on MathSpot, which is literally just the randomly generated key stage one to key stage, sorry, year one to year six sort of papers. Maybe should add into that section like the primary, maybe more primary specific things like the subitizing tool and the number frames and stuff like that. Bit more organization. There's nothing to stop it appearing in two sections if it's a manipulative and it's a primary specialist thing. I could chuck it in there. In the GCSE section, you might have the algebra tiles and GCSE questions. There's nothing to say a resource is sort of like stuck with one heading only. Almost it can be across headings, so that's something to think about as well. I've spent 10 years making 188 things, and only I know exactly what's there and how to get it, and I want the world to know like that there's all this stuff and this stuff's related to this stuff, and like if you load up this resource, it gives you the option to load up this resource, like the question generators that I've mentioned. You fire up this question, then model it with these resources. And maybe, you know, I like completion tables, and I've only mentioned it once, but you load up a ratio question on a generator. You maybe model it with the bar modeling tool. You maybe do some practice questions. And then you might say, well, why not try this completion table on ratio as well? So linking all the, because there's about 30 odd completion tables, link those to a relevant generator question as well. Because the way these completion tables work, for those people are thinking, what on earth is a completion table, is they generally encompass a whole topic, every single sort of like nook and cranny of a topic that you might get with one big table. And depending what cells you reveal, like on the ratio ones, you hit different parts of that particular topic. So all of the ratio questions assigned to the one ratio completion table, and that's doesn't matter which one you're going through, it's going to be relevant resource. So that's another job that needs doing, but I'm working through the manipulatives for now, linking those to the generators.
Nice. I mean, yeah, it's going to be awesome. I think, I mean, it already is awesome, but yeah, like you said, you know, I think I would consider myself engaged with the site. And like I said at the start, I don't know how to get the most out of it, which is why I thought it'd be fantastic to sit down and talk to you about what you thought the best way to get the most from it was, you know?
Yeah, I'm fully aware that there's loads on there, but it's really hard at the moment. It's getting easier to maybe find exactly what you want. So yeah, that's my aim for this almost like next year kind of things, to stop making new stuff, improve the stuff that's already there, and make the stuff that's already there easier to find, and link it to relevant resources. So once you've clicked on a resource, where else can you go from this? So have that kind of journey, like you might start off with an example problem pair, then maybe do something under the visualizer, then jump to a model, then essentially go from the model to like a sheet of practice questions. Then after the practice questions, you might jump into your completion table, and then later down the line, jump to your test maker, where you test all the stuff that you've done over several weeks. So you have that whole sort of learning cycle, all the ingredients of a learning episode I like to talk about, like all the way from start to finish, like starting with your models and your metaphors and your representations, all the way through your worked examples, your example problem pairs, through to your practice and your tasks, and then end up at your assessment, and then start the cycle again with your next. It'd be nice if MathBot did all that for you, or at least nudge you towards the resources so that the teacher could then do that.
Which feature do you think is utilized least that you wish teachers used more, and why?
Listen, it's still the test maker. I want everyone to know about it because I think it's great. It's, if you've not tried it, just, it's a game changer. Like some of my department hadn't seen it, and they were like painstakingly making maybe these do knives from like typing out each question, or maybe snipping from a website or something. So you do know you can just literally pick your topics, dink, 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 create test, and it's there. And the URL's there for you with the difficulty level that you've selected. So tomorrow you just need to click on that link again, you get a new set of questions, and when you've taught under the topic, you just need to add one more checkbox, and then it's done. So yeah, I'll stick with the test maker. I'm trying to think if there's anything more original that I've not said. Something which I've not mentioned at all are the structured variation grids on MathSpot as well. I do a session on what they are. In fact, I'm doing one in Leeds in November, actually. But essentially, it's like a two-dimensional grid, and it exposes the structure of the maths being explored. So, like, I wouldn't introduce, say, standard form any other way now than with a Gattegno structured variation grid. So, if you check out that on MathSpot and have a play with it, and essentially, it's like it's your Gattegno's chart. Where you can reveal the cells individually, but you can also scroll to the right, scroll to the left, scroll up and scroll down. So it's infinite in each direction. And above just the normal numerals, well, that you'd expect on a Gattegno chart, the cells are split in two. So you can also show what it looked like in standard form as well. So you can have maybe 7,000, then above it, a little cell that says 7 × 10³. And all of the grids work in the same way. And they're just really fun to have a play around with, and they're really good for those what do you notice and what do you wonder. You just reveal a couple of cells and you say to the class, okay, what do you think is going to be in the rest of this row, or what do you think is going to be in the rest of this column, and can you tell me why you think that's true? And before you know it, they're making all these conjectures, and more often than not, they're describing exactly the math that you want them to discover. So yeah, I found them really powerful here. If you want to read up about them, it's John Mason and Anne Watson did loads of stuff on them. Just type in structured variation grids, and there's loads of nice stuff to read on.
Yeah, I think I've seen you speak about that a few times, Johnny, as part of some of, you know, you hear lots of things that I like to.
Yeah, I've done two MathCom sessions on them. I reused it. I don't often reuse my sessions, but I figured it was different ends of the country, so I'll use it twice. In fact, no, I think one was online. And one was down in Gloucester, I think it was. So, yeah, I got a couple of uses out of that one. But it's due for a comeback, to be honest. So, yeah, it's been a good 2 years since I did it. So, yeah, probably do it again.
Yeah, I think it would have been Gloucester I saw you in. And also one of the, I don't know if it was a full MathsConf or if it was a MathsConf online.
I definitely did it online. One of those mini ones, probably, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, they're fantastic. Like you say, once you've seen someone use them, and you're thinking, well, how can I use them in my class? How can I get the same principles and stuff?
And the nice thing about those sessions as well, because you talk through what a structured variation grid is, and you show some of the really nice examples that you've used in the class. And then going back to that point that like the delegates are normally like the best resource, because then you say for the last 10 minutes or however long you've got, okay, can you think of how you might apply a structured variation grid to a topic of your choosing or a topic that you've got coming up? So then all the delegates are furiously thinking what topics they've got coming up. They come up with a structured variation grid, which they can take away and potentially use in the classroom. And then they'll share their idea with me as well. And then that just gives me more items for my never-ending to-do list. But it's fun. It really is fun, and it's useful. So, yeah, that's... That's a nice way of getting a few extra ideas during a MathCom session.
So you've mentioned your never ending to-do list a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you've been making countless changes over the summer. How have you prioritized them? Has it been, I mean, it's pretty clear you've got a plan for how you see maths, but in its almost, I don't know, ideal state. But obviously, Patreon supporters can, like Neil, can request changes if they want, can they? How have you weighed those up? Because I know a lot of people do.
Essentially, I obviously need to earn some money. And Thursday and Friday, I'm not getting any income other than what I can get from Patreons and the ads, which are on Massport at the moment. So the plan is long term to try and get sponsors for each of the sections on Massport. So maybe the primary section sponsored by someone, the manipulative section sponsored by some big manipulative provider and so on. We've already got the Hue cameras sponsoring the camera tool and the tools section of the site. And Julia Smith as well is sponsoring a section of the GCSE site, the GCSE exam countdown with her 5 hours revision. So there's a couple of people interested so far. And basically, I'm on the lookout for sponsors. So if you have a website and you want to sponsor a section of the site, get in touch and we'll talk it through. And then what I do is I remove the Google ads from that page. Those annoying Google ads that pop up everywhere. They're annoying, but essentially I've got a server to pay for and I've got childcare fees to pay for, which are not cheap. And I need to earn some money on the Thursday and Friday. So that's how I do it. So it'd be lovely if I could get a little sponsor for each of the sections of the site, remove Google ads entirely, and then patrons still get their little perks of sort of like, they can request me on their to-do list. They get their own little Google Forms to-do list and stuff like that. So hopefully it's still useful to be a patron as well. I've got some other ideas for patrons up my sleeve as well. Things like maybe some sort of like online CPD and stuff like that of how to use the manipulatives, but maybe offer that out free as well. I'm not sure, but the long-term plan is remove Google Ads entirely and it supported entirely by sponsors for each section or patrons as well. That'd be lovely.
Nice. I mean, Hue cameras have been mentioned so many times, Johnny. I'm going to be expecting some of the commission you got for that sponsorship
And
because they haven't spot, they
don't
haven't
forget
put
Julia,
me.
don't forget Testmas Julia as well with her 5 hours. I need to mention her at least just as much as well. That's not fair. But otherwise, well, no, those are the first two. And to be fair, they kind of got in touch with me a little bit, and obviously I know them quite well. So we'll give it a trial run, and hopefully other people will jump on the bandwagon and get their sight on. So I don't know if Bruno Reddy and that lot's looking out now, and he wants his timetable Rexars on the primary section of the site. Then I'm all ears.
Yeah, I mean, they'd be daft not to. And I think, yeah, I mean, I don't maximize my Patreon account with you. I haven't sent you any emails with requests at like Sunday night at 11 o'clock. So yeah, maybe in the future I'll have to have to start sending my requests in. I think it's a really good way to support creators, artists that that give a lot for and don't expect much in return. You know, because like you say, you're not looking millions for this. What is a site that's worth its weight in gold, I think.
Well, I mean, patrons do get the ad-free version as well, which I should probably mention. So that does remove all the Google ads straight away, which is handy. So, but essentially, I want it to be login free. So, you have to type in the current ad-free code if you want to get rid of the Google ads. But essentially, the entire site is free to use to anyone that stumbles upon it, because busy teachers don't have time necessarily to remember what the login is or forget password, reset it and stuff like that. I just want it to be fire it up. There's my camera, there's my example problem pairs, there's my completion table or whatever, and crack on kind of thing. So that's the plan. Always login free is the plan. And I've
This
said that for 10 years now, so I'm sticking to it.
this month's password is really easy to remember as well. It's a good
It is.
one.
Oh yeah, I sent it out, didn't I, yesterday? So maybe we'll give the readers a free glimpse of it now. It's a bit early in the month. Sometimes at the end of the month, I'll say what the password is just for the last 5 days or something, so people experience it. But once you go ad free, it's like sometimes when I forget to log on, it's like, what's all these adverts about? Put the code in, that's it, and
So
just sigh relief.
let's do some quick maths. I think I've got an episode. This will be Saturday. Then we'll do. I've got another two. So what about in the last episode of this season, Johnny? Will I tell people the password as part of my closing remarks or something, or hide it somewhere in an episode?
Until I change the passcode again, which will be sometime in November, I imagine. Now.
What can we expect, maybe not necessarily from MathSpot, but from you over the rest of the academic year, Johnny? Any big plans for 23-24?
Yes, there's loads of gaps I want to plug in MathSpot in terms of the question generators. Because depending on what year group I teach and whatnot, sometimes I'll miss some of the higher topics. Now, I've not had a higher group for a few years, so I've got like a decent set of sort of quite high attaining year 10, so I expect some of the missing higher topics to appear this year. But the overarching theme of this entire year will be getting MathSpot to work together as a complete package. So you can just go in and you know you're teaching something to do with fractions, you start typing fractions in, it'll be the fractions example problem pair, it'll be the Cuisenaire rod modeling tool, it'll be the test maker with all the prerequisites to fractions and things like that, getting the whole site, the user experience of the site just as good as it can be, so people, it's almost like a default choice for teachers to go to. That's what I want as many teachers as possible using the site because it's really useful, rather than like the maybe more specialist few. There's a few people, like a few really close friends now, who like know everything about MathSpot, like, but like that's not the normal user. The normal user goes on the question generator, fires up 30 questions on fractions of amounts, and then maybe potentially moves on, rather than all misses out on all the good stuff that MathSpot can do. So yeah, that's it. Not make necessarily new stuff, but link all the stuff together.
So exciting. I cannot wait to see this in full flow. Brilliant.
Yeah.
And we test out with the boys at home. Oh, come on, boys. It's time to do your math spot.
Oh, there'll certainly be more of a primary focus as well, because my little lad's just started year one as well. So whatever maths he gets up to into year one, expect me to go through the years and add all the primary content. Backfill that as well. That's going to all get added. So, yeah. Maybe when he's doing A-levels in a few years down the line as well, I'll add some A-level content as well. There's one or two bits, but not much so far.
Yeah, I mean, you've got about 5 or 6 years before he's ready for his A-levels, so
maybe.
Always a pleasure, Johnny. All I have to do is say thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me, Kieran.
And to everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.